You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
And here we are. You've got Mel with another incredible person. And today our guest is Professor Michael Spitzer from the University of Liverpool. And as you might guess, he's a professor of music. Where else but Liverpool? Michael, it's wonderful to have you on the show.
It's great to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Yes, and you have a wonderful, and I mean wonderful, new book out called The Musical Human, which is like, for me, it's like Yuval Noah Harari on human beings, the whole other side. Like he missed out on the musical man. So it's a good thing we have you. He should read your book. I mean, okay, but we start the show with a jingle. And I was wondering whether I should play the jingle because you're a professor of musicology. And then I said, okay, today we're going to let our hair down. You're not going to tell me how lousy it is, right? And we're just going to have fun talking about The Musical Human. Is that fair enough?
Fair enough.
Okay, well, you're a captive audience now. Here we go.
Get a chair, grab a seat, or we'll sweep you off your feet. We move, we groove, you got Mel. Ease your legs, rest a while, all you gotta do is smile. We're swell, can't you tell, you got Mel. When the show begins, you better hold on real tight. Or before you know it, you'll be high as a kite. Take a break, settle down, we're the only show in town. SRO, don't you know, you got Mel. Give it up, don't think twice, we're a hurricane on ice. What the hell, give a yell, ring your bell, show and tell. Mademoiselle, give a smell, you got Mel.
You've got Mel.
And Mel has to get rid of this. And now, Michael. So, thanks so much. I've interviewed 130 people on the show, but I don't remember getting so excited. Because your book fills in so many missing things in my musical life. And worse than that, or better, I have a million zillion questions to ask you. There's no way we're going to finish today. We're going to have to do this another 20 times. Your book is all about the musical man. It's hundreds of pages. It's documented. It's all referenced. What would you like to share with people who are not musicologists? What for you? By the way, in this interview, I just want your opinion, right? Not what other people think, what Michael thinks. What is the musical man to you, and why did you write this book?
I wrote the book because I can't imagine a world without music. And it's a burning desire to share my passion with people. And to look, we tell an extraordinary story in universities, and people are daunted or put off by how scary or technical music can be. I wanted to reach out over the ivory tower, over the walls of universities, and tell the story that we know. It's an extraordinary story. Stretches for millions of years, that, you know, mankind is only a footnote, and music has been going on, hundreds of millions of years. Insects have music, whales have music, birds have music, and I argue that music is the most important thing that sapiens ever learned to do. And this word sapiens, we know it, of course, from your compatriot in Israel, Harari. Mm-hmm. And frankly, I was really inspired when I first came across Harari's Sapiens a few years ago. It's one of those moments where you think, oh my God, this is such an obvious thing to say, the story of where we came from. As you said in your introduction, he doesn't talk at all about music, and arguably music is the most important thing that we ever did, and my book shows that. History is written by the victors, and the victor of evolution is language. But music is actually older than language. That's a funny thing. It's millions of years older than language, and that blows my mind. So why is music a Cinderella? You know, it's always, people talk about it being having no purpose, no value. What's the point of music? Well, I think we all know what the point of music is. It's like the air we breathe, so pervasive that we take it for granted. It's invisible, like the air, but we would die without it.
So one of the things that's problematic in your book is that insects have music and whales have music, but other primates don't. So that's a little mishigane, as we Jews would say. But before we go back to that, tell us something about your life. Start with, you know, baby Michael.
It's a funny story. My parents were immigrants to Palestine, Israel, after the war. My mother was in a concentration camp. Both were Hungarian. They made it to Israel and went straight away into a kibbutz for a few years, a Hungarian communist kibbutz, apparently.
Which kibbutz?
I don't know. It's in Rehovot. Mm-hmm. And then my father went into the building trade. Nobody in my family was educated. I was the first person in my family to go to university and the first musician as well. I was born in Africa, in Nigeria, because my father got a job as he built water purification plants in Nigeria. I was born there. And then we straight away came back to Israel. Hebrew was my first language. I forgot every word of my native language. How about that? I'm now English, but I'm deceptively English. So we emigrated from Israel to England in the Yom Kippur War in 73 for political reasons, I think.
Wow.
Well, my father was a fairly left-wing, and the country was not anymore anyway, not for the rise of Likud in the early 70s. So I quickly embraced my adoptive culture and became English and went through a very typical standard English educational system. I was lucky enough to gain an open scholarship to Oxford. And I never looked back. I wanted to stay within academia.
No, but you've missed out here 15 important years, Michael.
Oh, yeah.
This interview is about you. You know, savor the moment. What were you like as a kid, and how did you come to music?
Well, very late in the day, I heard my father put on records, Mahler, Beethoven, and I, as a very young kid, I felt like there was holiness or gold pouring out of this. It was a mystery. I didn't know what it was, but I knew I was drawn towards it. But because we had no money, I didn't have the chance to play anything until I was 13, which was a piano. That's very late in the day to...
What's that? Wait, you didn't grow up in Liverpool?
No. I missed out. If it interests people, we started off in the south of England, in a very undistinguished seaside town called Herne Bay, about 60 miles from London, where my father ran a junk shop, or kind of borderline junk stroke antiques. And, in a Dickensian way, I didn't have a childhood. I helped my father carry furniture or sell secondhand books. He didn't give me any money. I wasn't paid anything. So he was a working...
He was a communist anyway.
He was a working childhood.
Exactly. Proletariat.
Yes.
And then your first piano when you were 13?
Yeah, my father came across a secondhand piano and I touched it. I liked what
Michael, one second, I have to stop you here. You know, because the musical man, you know, father had his junk store, always secondhand, everything from something to a baby grand. Right?
Yes.
So yes. You're a secondhand rose.
Yes.
Wonderful. So your father got a secondhand piano when you were 13, and then what happened?
I began to take lessons. And did quite well.
You performed?
Amateur, never professional. I realized that I would never be quite good enough to be a professional. So I went sideways from being a performer to being a professor.
And you studied musicology in the university?
I went to Oxford and did a first degree in musicology and then a doctorate concentrating on Beethoven.
And like then, you're the world expert on Beethoven.
One of them, several.
Well, for me, you're the expert.
Thank you very much, Mel.
I'm going to ask you a question about Beethoven and classical music in general.
Yeah.
But before that, you ended up at the University of Liverpool.
Not quite. My first job, I taught for 20 years in Durham University, which is near Scotland. Durham, it's like Oxford. It's a medieval university. And I was very happy. And I was there for 20 years and then was offered a full professorship in Liverpool 10 years ago. So I moved down there. Very happy there.
Yeah, and you're tenured now?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, the UK...
So, Michael, you know, I was a professor for many years. And we're always afraid of the jazz police. You know what the other people will say. But... You know, at the end of the day, who cares? I play my best music when nobody important is listening to me. You know, the moment that you say the jazz police are here, you have to worry. At least so for today, we're not going to worry. But, you know, you are at the University of Liverpool.
Yeah.
I want to come visit you for my 70th birthday.
You're very welcome.
And interview you and walk along the streets of the Beatles.
Yeah.
And to do like a rollover Beethoven.
Yeah.
And so you're a professor specializing in, among other things, Beethoven in the City of the Beatles.
I don't specialize in Beethoven. I teach anything they want me to. When I moved from Durham down here, I had to go native. And because the culture here, of course, is the majority of my students are popular music students. So I teach pop music. when I teach a module on aesthetics, the majority of the kids, where they're coming from is pop music. So I adapt.
You teach a course in popular music?
Yeah.
So do I.
Yeah, good.
Now, I don't know if it's good. You might not think it's good for a professor of microbiology to teach a course in popular music. I think it's good.
Yeah.
But you know a lot more than I do.
Liverpool, it's much more diverse or multicultural in its music. It's very healthy for me to migrate, actually, from Durham, which is very traditional, to this very modern and vibrant place. Very conducive to free thinking. So I wouldn't have been able to write my book if I stayed in Oxford or Durham. It's quite liberating coming here.
Yes. Yeah. And your book is very well researched. Maybe like a little bit too well for my taste as a university professor. But it's all over the place in a good way. It's really eclectic. It's really universal. And that's, I saw you giving that TEDx talk in India, and I said, wow, I have to get to know this guy. Amazing. So I guess the first question is, why is music so important if apes, monkeys, and other primates don't do it?
Look, the story is, if you look at the big picture, birds have music and they can sing. They have a faculty called vocal learning, which means that they're not confined to the calls they're born with, but can create new songs. And very few species have vocal learning. Cetaceans have it, which is dolphins and whales and seals, they have it. Apes don't. Apes, as a rule, can't create new melody. And this is very strange because we evolved along the ape line and we can create. So where did it come from? So the problem was this discontinuity between apes and birds. Apes are very good at gesture. They can create new gestures. But they can't create new sounds. Somewhere along the line, apes or Australopithecines and hominins, which are our ancestors, they reconstructed this lost gift of creating music. And so the big picture is that music is always, for sapiens, artificial and a bit fake. We're faking it. Birds, it comes naturally to birds. We have to work hard to create the craft. But that isn't to say we aren't all born with a capacity to be musical. And one of my take-home messages is that we're all born with this capacity to be musicians. And in the West, the tragedy is that we're nearly all of us consumers, we're passive consumers. And we think that music is in the hands of, dare I say, musicians. There's this barrier between those who make the music or perform it and those who listen to it, the audience. And nearly all of us don't participate in making music. And if you compare that with the rest of the world outside the West, it isn't the case. There isn't this artificial distinction between performers and composers and listeners. Everybody joins in at their own level. It's very accommodating to people of different levels.
It's the jazz police all over again.
It is.
But let me tell you what I understood from your book. You can trash me as much as you like. You know, in Yuval Noah Harari's book, which is kind of like, you know, the yin to your yang, he also says, we don't know how people develop language, but that's what makes us people. Mm. And what I understood from your book is that language grew out of song, out of music.
Sure.
That was Freudian, but it wasn't really. Because, you know, people ask me, why do I have good accents in many different languages that I can barely speak? And I answer, it's because I'm a musician. But then I read your book, and it kind of made sense. Because every language is a song. You know, if you listen to Portuguese, se você que desafina o amor, saiba que isto em mim provoca imensa dor. I mean, you can't write in notation, but you probably could. Languages sing, don't they?
Yeah. Well, we call that, or linguists call that aspect of language prosody. Prosody is the tempo, the rhythm, the contour, the melody of language. Language puts syntax and semantics front and center, not prosody. Whereas music puts contour and dynamics and tone first and syntax second. It isn't quite what I say. I think when you go back millions of years, you can't distinguish language from music with the same thing. Then they branch out and one profiles prosody and one profiles syntax and they branch out. But where music is more useful for us is because it's a full brain and body experience. That much more than language, music accesses every part of the brain and body. The emotions, the memory, physical movement. You can't dance to language, you know. And most importantly, music is social. It's all about doing it with other people. So even when you're in your armchair and you think you're alone, you're not really, because you're plugging yourself into a social network, because every song is full of social cliches. But in origin, music was about singing and dancing together. And the function of music was to bind the pack together through what anthropologists call social or vocal grooming. Vocal grooming is that you're grooming the monkey, the ape, not with your hands, but with your voice. And you can literally broadcast your voice over the entire community, but you can't, of course, feel them all at the same time. So vocally, you can reach out much more. And when you dance together, joined rhythm. Rhythm is an astonishing thing, because if you all move to the beat, it's worth coordinating life. You get routines, you get labor, you get hunting practices. And the concept of rhythm is so all-encompassing. All life is rhythm. Like, you know, the rhythm of what we're doing now, our conversation is rhythmic. We're turn-taking, we're nodding with each other. So what we call music gradually crystallizes out of rhythm, out of the rhythm of life, right? So rhythm is everywhere, but as a distinct practice, music gradually evolves out of this all-encompassing kind of rhythm.
Absolutely. But, you know, I think that when you write a really good book, people can misunderstand you, and that's okay. So that's my reader response, because you got me going in all kinds of ways. And now I'm looking at language as a subset of music, as a particular kind of music.
Yeah.
And this has a lot of, like, for example, when I'm teaching my course in popular music, okay, I teach the students that most popular songs have words. Why do they have words? Why do popular songs need words? And I say, I'll give you an example of a popular song from the 50s that barely has no understandable words, and none of you will know it. And I start singing The Witch Doctor, which is from about 1958 or something, you know. Ooh, wee, ooh, ah, ah, ding, dang, walla, walla, bing, bang. All my students know it. It's like from 65 years ago. And we love music, popular music, that has words, even if the words are in French or Italian or Portuguese, and we don't know the words, but we need the words. We need the unintelligible words in our popular songs.
Yeah.
That was a question.
Oh, it's a question.
It just didn't have a question mark.
Well, I think if you go across the world, most cultures don't have a distinctive category called music. What they call music incorporates poetry, song, and dance. So our notion of music being purely instrumental is quite artificial. And music is multidimensional, and it includes song lyrics. It's unusual to have music without song, without words.
But even if you can't understand the words?
No. Is that the vocal instrument is a musical instrument. It sounds nice.
Exactly.
And it communicates emotion and intention. You know,
yes.
Intent.
Do you like saxophone?
It's not my favorite instrument.
Okay.
I prefer piano and trumpet, horn.
Okay, well, you know, saxophone is a kind of horn.
It's a vocal instrument. It's like somebody...
Exactly. Yeah. But I think so is violin.
Yeah.
I hear a voice in violin. But the other thing I learned from your book is that everything about music is our own experience on the planet. Like the rhythms of music, except maybe for some very eccentric metal, are rhythms that we can associate with, that we can walk to, run to, jump to.
Yeah.
And that was like a real revelation for me. I want to ask you now a question, which is the main question that I ask my students in my popular music course. And my students are not studying music at Tel Aviv University. So it's a different kind of course. So my course is about life in a different way than probably your course is. And the whole semester, we're dealing with one question. What makes an immortal popular song? What makes a popular song that people still love to sing after 60, 80, or 100 years? And I've been waiting now to ask you that question. I have an answer, but what do you think?
Well, we run a master's program in Liverpool called the Music Industry, and the people who run it, their view is that what makes an immortal popular song is the music industry. It's constructed, packaged, and sold. There's a grain of truth to that. If we knew what made an immortal song, we would industrialize it, we would package it, we'd all become millionaires. No one knows. If they did know, there wouldn't be a problem. It's partly luck. There's a lot of hard work. It's a mixture of luck, hard work, and 1% inspiration.
Oh, what, like inventions and yeah. Anything else, really?
Yeah.
In my course, I spend a lot of time talking about the songs of Tin Pan Alley, the Great American Songbook,
yeah.
Where it's harder to invoke this huge, you know, MTV generation, digital music and so on. And of course, marketing was very important back then and who got to perform the song. But if there's a song from the 1940s that you like, I'm sure there are many, you have to ask yourself, why these songs persisted for 80 years?
In the book, the analogy of the Beatles, and why not focus on them given I'm speaking from Liverpool? What's distinctive about popular song compared to writing it the way Mozart wrote a symphony? It's collective. So the core of the Beatles is a relationship between two people, between John and Paul. And then, of course, three people with Harrison, and if you want to include Ringo, he didn't write very much, but I think the dynamic of four people creating together is very distinctive of a popular song. And it has to work. They have to like each other. They have to get on with each other. That's one thing. The other important thing is all the hard work and the practice that the Beatles gained in Hamburg, the journeyman years in Hamburg, where they were playing twice a day, every day of the week for years. That's professionalism, that's craft. And you can't get away without craft and professionalism. It's no different to being a great cook. Now, I'm a reasonable cook. I could never run a restaurant because I don't have the technique to be a professional. The same with telling jokes. You're probably a funny guy, but are you a professional comic? A professional comic is somebody who can get out there twice a day on the stage and always infallibly make people laugh because they have a technique. And that's no different from being a popular song artist.
Okay, so Michael, I'm going to jump in. So this is another thing from your book. And by the way, I should say you have another book from last year.
Yeah.
Oxford University Press, which I also have to read, from chanting to pop music.
Yeah.
I don't, you're extremely prolific. Two big books in 2 years. But getting back to the craft of the Beatles, okay, they still had over 200 songs, and not all of them are equally good. And you're much younger than I am, but there were other bands at the time, like the Dave Clark Five and other bands, Procol Harum, that had 1.5 hits. The Beatles had something. And one of the things that I wanted to ask you is that something their inability, I'm going to say relative inability, to read music?
Well, they didn't read music. They didn't. They chose not to.
I'm being nice, but it you know, when I go to the library, I find these tomes of learned professors. Some of them are your friends, who write these books on the Beatles, all of the harmonies and the changes and the scales that they used. And I'm thinking to myself, you jerks, they wrote the book.
It's unfair. Look, everything that Beatles scholars discover in the songs is actually there in the songs.
Yeah.
Right, so when you and I speak English, we don't need to think about the linguistic structure of what's happening in our complicated speech. It's still there. When Chomsky comes along and discovers the generative processes, we don't have to consciously be aware of that. It's very complex, but we do it through habit and learning. It's not second nature. It's not something we're born with. We have to gradually learn how to speak. But developmental psychology says that you can internalize and naturalize its processes. And music is the same. You don't have to be aware of how complex your song is for you to sing a complex song. It's up to the scholar to come along and to show you what's going on under the surface. And that can be interesting. You know, it can be, to spend a day or so thinking about unpacking, it's like analyzing a song, can enrich your appreciation of the brilliance of a song or the symphony. And it's no different to reading a book about, you know, a novel you admire. If you really love a novel, it can be helpful to read a literary critic who will unpack what's going on.
Yeah, but okay, exactly. So I write children's books, okay? This is really a good conversation, and maybe I was a little bit too harsh on my colleagues, because I have a chip on my shoulder with the music department at Tel Aviv University that goes back 40 years.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
But essentially, I'm going to take it back. You're right. But if I'm writing a children's story and I'm saying, am I using the rule of threes here? Am I showing, not telling? My writing is going to be different. I just have to get into the zone and write a damn good story. And then go back over it and say, what have I done? Do I have enough show and tell? Show, not tell? Do I have enough repetitions? And You know, I think the Beatles just had fun writing and they were these hugely gifted people. But Michael, I want to ask you the following question. Let's say that you and I, in order to have this talk, we would have to think in words, in written words while we were having it. And when you wrote that in your book, I said, yeah, what a big difference. What a gift people who are musical but don't learn notation have. Because we now listen to music with our left brains, or metaphorically.
Yeah.
They don't. Ella Fitzgerald and Billie Holiday and the Beatles and probably Chet Baker and others. Even if they knew notation, they weren't paying attention to it.
It's one path, the novel, the Freudian slip, the book, in the historical part, and the central part of the book is about the civilizations of music. So not just the West, but China, India, Africa, and Islam, beginning with, Mesopotamia and the Middle East and the Bible, the biblical lands and Rome and Greece. It's a story of plurality, and each one is a pathway, a completely valid pathway. And the path that the West took, which happened to be through music notation, is no better and no worse than the other paths. But every path you take has consequences. It's linear. So I say that Islamic music is—it's not about harmony or polyphony. It's about ornamentation, and as with the ornament, the decoration of Islamic visual culture. Similarly, in China, the story is about color, not so much about rhythm. It's about timbre, and what's characteristic there is the sound of gongs and bells. Whereas, if you compare that with Greece. Greek music was obsessed with strings, the harp and the lyre. So Greek theory came from subdividing a string, whereas Chinese theory came from thinking about the partials of a gong. And the immensity of Chinese civilization goes its own way. Music is handed down, not through writing it down, but through the master-disciple relationship where the master hands down a way of playing to the disciple, and that's learned through observation and imitating. And there's this tremendous chain, this oral traditional chain, and in the West we prefer to disseminate music by writing it down onto paper. Yeah, but look, I adore Mozart. I'm not going to compare Mozart with Chinese music or Carnatic music. These are different civilizations. They're different games, and people like cricket or soccer or rugby or ping pong or snooker, and each game has its own rules, its own fan base, its own ethos, and the human is very good at flexibly switching between different language games, as Wittgenstein calls it. I have a capacity to always be changing games, and we're very, very comfortable in moving between languages, fashions, games, genres. And this flexibility is one of the things which also defines our species. We're far more plastic or flexible than any other species on the planet. And that also goes for our capacity to enjoy Beethoven as much as we enjoy Ella Fitzgerald.
Absolutely. But it is a, there is a huge cultural element, and this is so strong in your book also. So you grew up listening to Beethoven, and I grew up listening to Chazanut, to cantorial music, and tomorrow evening is Yom Kippur, so Ashkenazi Jews have this this song, no words, da 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 di da dum di da 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 di da da dum. I get goosebumps every time I think about it. It's like what you say, it's this like universal joining in of millions of voices in your mind while you sing this, and so many memories.
I think you've got to be quite cautious, Mel, because this is your music. And yeah. We all have our own musics.
Of course. It's just for me.
Yeah.
Yes.
And every culture on the planet has its own music.
Of course.
So it's to be slightly sober, one limit to saying music is universal. Actually, it's not. Because every culture has its own scales and rhythmic patterns and instruments. You have to get used to that. Underneath that surface, you have the emotions, which of course are, emotions are universal.
But you know, while I was reading your book, because I was reading it online, I could go to a lot of the Chinese music and the Tibetan and all kinds of things that I had heard but never listened to.
Yes, yes.
So then I went online and I listened to it, and I did have a kinship with the music.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't get goosebumps like a young kid sitting in synagogue. But I did have a kinship with the music.
You can. It's a starting point or a doorway. But I would imagine that people who spend their whole lifetimes with that music probably get a lot more than we do from a first impression. And that's the journey. To be exposed to unfamiliar music is the first step on a journey. It's like meeting a person. You might like them, may be attractive, but you begin a relationship with them. You may end up marrying them. But it's a journey, and you take the rough with the smooth. I like the people.
So, yes. So one of my visions reading your book, and I had plenty, was some primitive man, I don't know how many years ago, imitating a bird. In other words, you talked about the anatomy of vocal cords, and that's also part of it, you know, our unique ability to have flexible vocal cords. But I think that there was a primitive man somewhere, and this might have happened many times in many places, who mimicked the birds. Maybe we learned to sing by imitating not only the pounding of our hearts and the stomping of our feet when we walk.
Sure. And this happens all across the world in hunter-gatherer societies today, where through shamanistic cultures, humans are intermingled, intertwined with animals in every level of their life. And Darwin wrote about this. It's a faculty called mimesis or mimesis. We are very good at imitating. And, you know, hundreds of thousands of years ago, and also today, in cultures such as the the Inuit in North America, or the Kaduli in Papua New Guinea, or the large parts of Australia, it's common for people to imitate birds, but also other animals, bats and reindeer and seals and whales.
Yeah. And to hunt them also.
You hunt them, you consume their flesh, you identify with them. It's a way of explaining the cosmos from a certain perspective, that you are part of nature. Nature is in the great circle of life. So yes, of course, at some point people did imitate birds, but also they imitated seals and reindeer.
The consequence of this is that we learn to speak by imitating the song of other animals. The song.
Yes, it was certainly there, but I think it was the basis of learning to speak was a slow, gradual process. So we know that because we can recover the FOXP2 gene, which is associated with speech acquisition, and we know that there is a degenerate version of the gene in Neanderthals, and a much more mature version in sapiens 200,000 years ago. So we could and neurolinguists have a story about how the capacity to create symbolic language crystallizes about 100,000 years ago. At about the same time, we learn how to imitate, how to create realistic painting and figurines. Mm-hmm. So the cognitive maturity of sapiens about 50,000 years ago is an ability to create symbolic language, but also to represent reality realistically.
Yeah, but you see, Michael, what I'm learning from you is that maybe Yuval Noah Harari didn't really get it right, because his theory is that people learned to tell stories 50,000 years ago. And when I read your book, I had a different notion, that people actually learned to sing stories. His contention is that when you can tell a story, you know, my God, my history, my legend, and gather more than 150 people.
No, I think that's,
isn't that what churches do?
The proof of that, look, it's a silent movie from the 20s, and there's no speech at all. There's just music and this gesture. And actually, people don't need language very much. If you look at people who know each other very well, old married couples are really good friends. They smile, they nod, they touch each other, they be with each other. Language is overrated. It's emotion and gesture or intonation or vocalization, an extraordinarily rich and efficient medium for communicating emotion and intention and ideas. You don't need to conceptualize it. And it comes from heightened intonation. That's the origin of language. Darwin knew that, actually. Darwin always postulates that language originates in animal calls. Where Darwin was wrong, he thinks it's all about sex. It's not just about sex. He thinks it comes from the passions of mating calls. And the story he tells is about sexual selection through the most beautiful song in the forest, the most beautiful tale on the peacock. The origin of that.
Yeah, but if you take that and you combine it with the other stuff you've written and Harari, then his contention that is supported by anthropologists is, you know, you need a global village in order to have this new man. And you have to extend beyond the 100 or 150 people in my particular family. But it doesn't have to be by telling a story. It could be by singing a really good story. And that brings me back to your chapter about the whales, which is incredible. So if there were these people who could sing a story the same way you have other cultures singing stories, I remember this from your book,
Then
you don't have to actually speak. You know, if I have a good song.
Yeah.
Then I can have more than 150 people singing my song.
This is very, very late in the day. Singing stories beyond the campfire, tell the story of where your ancestors came from, comes very, very late in the story of evolution. 3 or 4 million years before that, we are using song for much more basic things like coordinating hunters to hunt an animal, or to soothe a baby, or to reassure people, or to share. What's extraordinary is the ability of music to create telepathy, to share a theory of mind, as linguists call it. So if we are moving in the same rhythm and sharing a kind of intonation, we're sharing an emotion and we're sharing a state of mind. That's incredibly important for creating society and for binding people together. That's a long way upstream from telling stories around a campfire. Much more fundamental than that.
Same thing with the rhythm, isn't it?
Rhythm, yeah. Rhythm comes first.
Yeah. This is incredible. Before I ask you my last question for today, what perplexes you most in your trying to understand the musical human?
Oh gosh, going back when you're telling me how much singing means to you, that the cantoric song means to you, it's quite hard for people to share enthusiasms with each other. So there are pieces I know which I would die for, and friends of mine think, meh. I'm thinking, for goodness sake, listen, are you not hearing what I'm hearing in this piece? There's no way of legislating about what is great music. It's so personal, and that's perhaps the saving grace. individually.
That perplexes you.
It does.
Yeah. Do you have a song? Okay, I have this experience. When I was about 7 years old, a new song called Volare, that Dean Martin sang. Volare, oh. Sure. Every time, Michael, it's not the best song I know by far, but every time I hear that song, I have some distant, you know, I have this great smile on my face. I'm transported to something, and I can't even remember the event. Do you have any songs like that from your childhood?
Sure. You'll laugh. It's Tom Jones as Delilah. And you know what? This goes back to my memory growing up as a child in Israel. It must have been 1971, and I was 4 or 5. And I think Delilah was in the air, and Tom Jones was popular in Tel Aviv. I don't know why. But, you know, that song, like all songs, they're like a sponge. They have an ability to soak up your life, soak up your memories. Like no other thing we do, much more so than language does. Music is like a mental sponge. And that's why we love it so much and why it's so personal. We have different sponges.
And we should, you know, we like different stories. We like different colors. But I feel that I found a highly educated kindred spirit, because I cannot live without music. During my scientific years, my students could not play radio in my laboratory.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't, if there was music, I couldn't concentrate.
Yeah. I understand.
They had to wear earphones, and even that drove me crazy.
I work in silence. I write in silence.
Yeah. I can write with, I sometimes go to a coffee house. That's another thing. And at some stage, when the music, I'm not listening to it, I can get into the zone. You know, there's applications that play you coffee house music with noise.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Great.
I think I want one.
It's another perplexing thing. The Tom Jones story coming from the world expert on Beethoven, that's a humdinger. All of my interviewees, I ask about the Beatles. So I'm going to ask you also, what is your favorite Beatles song?
Oh, easy. It's Here Comes the Sun.
Okay. Is there a reason?
It's beautiful. You know, if I wanted to, I can analyze it to death. I could tell you exactly what's going on. It wouldn't touch anything about that song. Makes no sense at all.
can you sing a few bars?
I'm a terrible singer. You know, no, I'm not doing that. I'm not going there.
Everybody on my program sings. There's no such thing. By the way, this is, we have to have another, one sec. We have to, before you sing, we have to have another program on this. There's no such thing as a terrible singer, because everybody can speak. And if speaking is a language, then singing is a language. So go ahead, go for it. No jazz police.
Here comes the sun, da 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 da. That's all you're getting out of me.
Come on, little darling.
That's all I'm doing today.
Michael, come on. 3 bars.
Oh. You know, I got a little article on the conversation called The Tone Deaf Professor. Have you seen it? It's notorious, where I talk about how I couldn't sing a note as a child. My teacher said, he was also Hungarian, that I have a voice like a cracked saucepan.
But why do you listen to those people? Now I have to come to Liverpool, because you can sing, and you sing very nicely.
Thank you.
And when I was 23, a master's student in my laboratory told me that I sang off key, which I do sometimes, most people do. I didn't sing for 20 years. But when I got over it, I produced 2 albums, I performed. And that's very interesting. I bet you that you sing very beautifully.
My wife stops me. You know, I'll tell you a funny story. When I was a school kid in England, I was 11 or 12, and the teacher gagged me. I was not allowed to open my mouth during choir practice. And she gave other children a reward if they ever ratted me out. Stephen said, Miss, at Spitzer Sang, they got a reward and I received a punishment.
Well, we have to, when I come to visit you in Liverpool, we have to do a special session on that. Michael, this has been incredible. Way more than I dreamed of, and I dreamed. Finally, I have met somebody who says what I've been thinking all these years, that we are basically musical beings.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Have a wonderful year. Shana Tova.
You too.
And I hope we stay in. Hope we stay in touch after this.
Take care, Mel.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye.